The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Heidi Matthews is an assistant professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School. In this week's podcast, she stops by to discuss her essay in the publication The Conversation, entitled Why the Kavanaugh Hearings Were a Show Trial Gone Bad. It's Wednesday, October 17th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. We've started a Zero Books reading group for our patrons. It's been running a couple months now. It costs $15 a month. And this month's book is Stuart Walton's Neglected or Misunderstood, Introducing Theodore Adorno. All of our supporters get access to the Symptomatic Redness and Alternative podcasts. And patrons who donate $5 a month or higher get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast as well, which means they get access to a second podcast every week. If you like this week's podcast, you might drop by our Patreon to hear Heidi Matthews discuss Kavanaugh and the law, which will be on the feed this weekend, or probably Monday, actually, because I'm going to a conference in Boise, Idaho, to discuss Jordan Peterson and the new reaction, along with Richard Wolff and Peter Rollins and Michael Brooks of The Michael Brooks Show and The Majority Report and many others. C. Derek Varn will be there as well. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Chicago's top 40 hit Hard to Say I'm Sorry from 1982. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Heidi Matthews and I discuss the Kavanaugh show trial.
With the question that's been bugging me. How can you say that show trials can ever be a good thing? That's what I'll start with.
So thanks, Doug, for wanting to chat about this piece a bit more in depth. I think the question of the show trial is a provocative but also a productive way, I think, of addressing whatever circus or we just witnessed with respect to the Kavanaugh hearings, in particular the fifth day of hearings, which was the day that dealt with Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's sexual assault allegations. And so that day was really set apart from the previous days, which were much more business as usual in terms of their content. So my piece focused particularly on that last day, on the sexual assault allegation day, and the sort of technology, the analytic technology of the show trial is something that I'm taking from political theorist Judith Schlar, who wrote this canonical political theory book in the 60s called Legalism, Law, Morals, and Political Trials. And Schlar herself was really an arch liberal theorist, and she was probably most famous for what she articulated as the liberalism of fear. That was her way of approaching liberal theory in general. So she's a liberal. So she's somebody I want to object to in my work in general, but she's just so striking in the way that she constructs her liberal theory in opposition to or at least in differentiation from ordinary liberals. In other words, basic idea with the liberalism of fear is that she wants the reason why we need liberalism and individual rights is that we need to be able to protect against basic inhumanity. In other words, sort of unnecessary cruelty. And so in some sense, it's like this basic Hobbesian idea. But she had this book that tried to make sense in particular of the Nuremberg trial. So in other words, that's the big post-World War II trial of the major German war criminals that was carried out between 1945 and 47 by the Allied powers at the end of World War II. And so she wanted to, and so there is a lot of, from a liberal legalistic perspective, there is a lot wrong with the Nuremberg Tribunal. It was imposing ex post facto law.
Yeah. I read an article in The Atlantic from 1946 this morning in preparation.
Did you?
For talking to you. It was called Nuremberg, A Fair Trial or a Dangerous Precedent? And yes. This guy, Charles Wysonski, who went to some length to state at the beginning that he thought what had happened in Germany, the crimes of the German state were real and that horrific and awful. But then he went on to say there was this quality to the charges, a few of them, that made them ex post facto, which meant that they were invented after the crime. It was basically a crime that had been invented to fit the circumstance rather than the other way around. And that's bad because it isn't fair to just invent new laws to punish people after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. So fundamentally unfair from that, from the point of view of the rule against basically, in international law, we call that the principle of legality. Just to say, you're only supposed to be put on trial or held responsible for crimes that were clearly criminal at the time, and that you also knew or should have known were criminal, right? And that wasn't the case at Nuremberg. Now, this goes back and forth. One can have the judgment itself spent a lot of time trying to overcome that particular objection, but at the end of the day, the objection stands, right? So, not to spend too much time on this, but the very short story is that Nuremberg. The big crime that Nuremberg was concerned with was the crime of aggression. In other words, the idea that Germany launched not only an illegal war, but a criminal war. And that was the main crime that was prosecuted. That's something that most people don't know. In fact, like we tend to think of Nuremberg as having been about prosecuting genocide, in particular the Holocaust. And it did do that a bit, but really the Holocaust was sublated to the overarching goal of actually prosecuting the criminality of the war as such. And so there were crimes against humanity prosecuted for the first time at Nuremberg, but those crimes could only be prosecuted insofar as they were committed in furtherance of the criminal aggressive war, right? So that actually, so it's this whole, so we could say a whole bunch more about that, but basically the idea that it was a fundamentally unfair trial for other reasons as well, including the quality of the defense resources, et cetera, but this is sort of the main objection.
And so, right. In this article, he breaks down
what each individual charge was and which ones might have had some legal standing because there was some law that was either fully formed or it was an open legal question that then the courts could decide on, you know. There was, I think it was around aggression and participation, whether or not individuals could be charged with the crimes of the state.
Exactly. Yeah.
Was the question, and he just felt that there was no legal precedence for that. There was no law that had been violated, and that there was no, and that meant that the trial wasn't really a trial. And it seems to me like the whole liberal notion of justice centers around this idea of fair play. It's not so much that we believe that formal procedures will ferret out the truth and bring real, you know, material substantial justice to the world, but that, like, through formal rules and procedures, we'll be able to maintain a system of rights. Most of all, and the right to freely enter a contract, the right to acquire and own property, those would be the two big ones.
Yeah. But so individual rights.
Individual rights.
And yeah. Private property. Yeah.
Right.
Those are the two key elements of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, so that's completely correct rendition. So Sklar was really struggling with this as a theorist, because she wanted to figure out a way in which she could make sense of the trial that didn't throw the whole thing in the dustbin of history or whatever for its violation of really core elements of liberalism. And the way she did that she has a whole book on it, but basically she wanted to differentiate the international political and legal sphere from the domestic sphere, right? So she's saying, look, we can't expect internationally to have the same sorts of procedural safeguards that we would have domestically, because especially writing in the time that she was, and about the Nuremberg trial, where she was writing about, the period when the United Nations was literally just being created and getting going. So there wasn't any sort of, strong international infrastructure at all. And certainly not the same kind of well-founded institutional structures, both in terms of the judiciary, but also the other prongs of government that we have domestically. So she's saying, look, we can't expect the same sort of fairness. And so how could we justify these trials? These trials, according to her, would be justified if, at the end of the day, the substantive politics that they were advancing made the world, including the particular political communities that they were addressed to, so in other words, transitional Germany, if they contributed to substantively, in other words, to the sorts of liberal values that she was committed to. And so for her, that also further meant focusing much less on the crime of aggression. She didn't think that was the thing that was important at Nuremberg, even though that's what the people at Nuremberg thought they were doing. She focused on the crimes against humanity aspect as being the moral center of the trial, right? That's exactly what she calls it. But she says, just reading from the book, it was only because the crimes against humanity were the moral center of the case that it could be justified at all.
Those crimes require a state of exception, or I mean, I don't know if from my reading, I'm not clear, because I read this article pretty quickly, but it seems like those crimes against the people in Germany and other parts of Europe were clear violations of some international law, and that you could prosecute without having to make an ex post facto.
No. So crimes against humanity. So there are two parts to that. One is the substantive idea of a crime against humanity, and a crime against humanity means basically widespread and systematic attacks against a civilian population. And those attacks can take various different forms, but you need to have the overarching requirement of widespread and systematic, and it has to be against a civilian population. So crimes against humanity had never been tried before. War crimes certainly had been, right? And that's a different thing. So war crimes had been around for a long time, since, you know, at least the 19th century, but very strongly codified in international law already in the 19th century. And war crimes, so specific common examples would be like mistreatment of prisoners of war, or extrajudicial killing in wartime, that kind of thing, right? So all of that was most certainly criminal. But crimes against humanity, in other words, the targeting of a civilian population on a widespread and systematic level, was not at all something that had ever been the subject of an international procedure. And what's more important, though, is that, or not more, at least as important, is that even if we could decide that the state was somehow liable for that activity, it's going an additional step legally to make individuals responsible for, as you said before, acts of state, what would previously be thought of as acts of state.
Now, war crimes, though, was already a you could be held responsible as an individual for war crimes.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. But that would take place, generally speaking, in a military tribunal, like a domestic military tribunal, court-martial, essentially, right? And that's still right. How it operates today.
Right. You know. So I'm sorry we're spending so much time.
No, I think it's important. Yeah.
But so my question here is, in other words, they could have been non-criminal acts and still been crimes against humanity. In other words, you wouldn't have necessarily violated any of the laws that applied to war, that you could, but just the targeting itself, even if you obey the rules, just like if you hold to the law, but nonetheless target a civilian population based on, say, ethnicity, that itself is a crime, regardless of how it's implemented. It's not merely a formal problem.
Well, I mean, as of once we get to Nuremberg, it is, right?
Right.
But every crime has to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But the idea is that it was ex post facto because it was only made justiciable. In other words, written down in the London Charter and carried out at the Nuremberg Tribunal after the crimes had already taken place. And generally speaking, you're supposed to have the legislation before you actually start implementing it, right?
Right.
So
okay. So my question now is, how does this relate to the notion of sovereignty that we might get from Schmitt, or this idea that that in order to make this move, that you need to have a sovereign subject who has the authority to transcend formal rules and act to create something like justice in the moment based on his or her or their authority rather than on the authority granted by rule of law.
Yeah. Okay. So let me see if I can make sense of that. Tell me if you want to redirect what I'm saying in any way.
Does that make sense?
It does. I think I know where you're getting, but if I'm wrong, just redirect me. So for Schmitt, there's a lot we can say about Schmitt, but Schmitt's basic, so in the concept of the political, which is the text that I was reading most explicitly alongside Schlar when I wrote about the Kavanaugh hearing. In the concept of the political, Schmitt is trying to delineate the concrete actual meaning of the political moment. So not party politics, quite separate from that. So but the political moment for Schmitt is the moment at which a sovereign entity decides on the friend-enemy distinction, right? So in other words, for him, and he says this at one point, he said, we only know, in fact, who the sovereign is by virtue, by looking, in other words, at who, in other words, the individual or entity or institution that's able concretely, in terms of effective power, to make that distinction, right? And the friend-enemy distinction for him is a very, very concrete thing. So it's not about just not liking someone else or being in partisan opposition to another political group. It's really about being in preparedness to actually destroy physically that other entity. And this is why Schmitt's theory has been so important in international relations, but also in terms of domestic relations, and we'll get to that. But it's been so important in international relations because it helps make sense of the authority that the state is taken to have on the international plane, right? So it's the state in general, it's the state that gets to decide on the exception. In other words, the state gets to decide who who it is. In other words, what other political grouping out there constitutes its enemy. In other words, who the state is willing to effectively go to war against. Not that they have to go to war. They may never go to war, but they need, if there is an enemy that's been determined, that is supposed to involve at least the preparedness to actually go to war.
So do you hold with that conception of the political, with Schmitt's conception?
Yeah. So I do. I kind of do. Now, I depart with Schmitt in several ways.
Can I say something very Twitterish and snarky?
Sure.
Probably the first way would be that you're not a Nazi, that you would depart
from
Schmitt.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
To be clear, I am not a rape apologist and I'm not a Nazi.
Okay.
Carl Schmitt was,
right? That's the irony here that he's being brought in to bear on justifying the Nuremberg trial.
Okay, so
right, and yet he was a Nazi, a major.
So let me be clear. So what I'm doing, so the way that I talk about, the way I put them in conversation is specific to this is my own theory of how they can talk.
But Sklar also turned to Schmitt at times, right?
She was not. I mean, I don't. It's not my impression that.
I checked it out. Before went in and said, what's Sklar's relationship to Schmitt? Because I saw it, Schmitt, in your piece, and I was thinking, where's Sklar relate to that? And so I looked it up, and there were a few articles written which were showing Sklar's citations of Schmitt. That's
she engages with Schmitt, but she engages with him deeply.
Yeah,
But because she wants to distance or differentiate herself from him, I think. Right.
The way Hegel did with Kant, right? I mean, Hegel's not at all Kant. Hegel is even in opposition to Kant, but Kant was a huge influence on Hegel. You couldn't get to Hegel without Kant. I mean, and that's just like, those are the two philosophers' names I know, so I'm throwing them around. But you know,
I have a good not. I mean, not to treat this like some kind of university seminar, but why not? You know, at the
end of the day. How I go. That's how I. This is how I roll.
That's fine by me. I mean, but there's a great. I'm just looking at this quote from Sklar where she wants to define. I mean, you know, what a show trial is, and according to her. A show trial, she'll call it a political trial. A political trial for her is a trial in which, I'm quoting from her now, the prosecuting party tries to eliminate its political enemies. I believe that's a quote I used in my piece. Mm-hmm. And she says, but to regard this as the essence of politics, one would have to accept Carl Schmitt's friend-enemy definition in its crudest. She recognizes that's... Right. In other words, a political or a show trial for her is a trial in which basically the end is already predetermined and function is to eliminate your political enemy. But that's not why she thinks show trials are a good thing. She thinks show trials can be a good thing when, in fact, there are other competing moral values that are sought to be achieved through the spectacle of the trial itself. And that's why for her, it's very clear, I think, right, that what the Allies were doing at Nuremberg, it was victor's justice in the crudest of forms. They were, it already eliminated the enemy physically, and now they want it to eliminate them sort of juridically, right? They want it to say at Nuremberg, the Allies, to the Axis, was that you were doing law wrong. That's why they had a judge's trial subsequent to the main trial to say you perverted the rule of law and we're now going to instruct you through our example.
Right.
But to do that,
they had to pervert the rule of law themselves.
Exactly. This is the whole paradox. Yes.
Right, right. Okay, so you do kind of hold with this friend-enemy distinction.
Oh, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see that playing out on Twitter every day. People – I think everyone kind of secretly is a follower of Schmitt.
Yeah,
online.
I think that's hard to refute. And I want to be clear as well, like Schmitt, we're talking about this as though it's the state only that does this, but his theory is actually much it is able to accommodate other sorts of political groupings besides like the modern state. I think we should be clear about that as well. So,
okay. So now, I have some other questions written down. Like I have so I just want to underscore this like one more time, and it's not really necessary, but when we say that American justice is blind,
right,
one thing we could say that it's blind to is this friend-enemy distinction.
I think that's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
That's totally right.
The way we can be blind to it is by sticking to these formal rules and sort of abandoning the notion of getting to actual justice. You know, like we're not trying to set the world as it absolutely should be in the eyes of God. We are sticking to a notion of fair play and trying to maintain a system that, you know, we've all freely entered into through contracts and negotiation as free individuals.
Well, this is why somebody like Kavanaugh can redeploy this metaphor of, you know, all we do in law is call balls and strikes.
Right. Right.
That's exactly where that comes in.
Yeah. And right. And you know, there's more to the game of baseball than that. But yes. But yeah, okay. So I'm not so sure I hate that idea, by the way. This is, you know, my problem as a Marxist would be to say, yeah, but no one's freely entered into these contracts. You know, the property relations aren't based on free individuals. We haven't gotten to a kind of society materially where we have free individuals. So all of this is just sort of baloney. But I mean,
yeah, I mean, Marx himself was like, I mean, a complete anti-liberal. Like he, I mean, because liberalism privatizes everything.
Right.
Right.
But the main problem was he wasn't like he was against the free individual. Like he was for that liberal project, I think. He was for the idea of the bourgeois individual. The problem was the bourgeois economy, the bourgeois ideology was never going to be able to achieve its own ends. It was never going to be able to create free individuals that could also live together in a community.
Yeah. I mean,
right. Sure. So in any case, so like, when I say that kind of thing, I'm thinking to myself, so we don't want to just throw away every – just because we can label something liberal, we want to make sure that we don't toss it into the garbage can. We might you know, this might be actually – there's some merit here. I do think that I'd much rather be brought up in front of a court which doesn't think that it already knows the truth, you know? and that only has recourse to a set of laws and rules, and where I have a shot at playing the game and winning.
Okay.
So that's what I would prefer. Now, not everyone has the same shot and all of that, but I still would prefer that.
I guess, like, though, the concept. So the one thing I would say about the internal limits, like the substantive limits of liberal legal systems, like as they get played out internally within states, is that what counts as a relevant argument before the courts is not going to take into account one's substantive conception of either justice or the good life or whatever, right? So those things, yeah, exactly. So when you come in and you want to argue, you know, you want to make an argument about, I don't know, like what you want to uphold aspects of the Affordable Care Act because you have a certain conception of democracy. Like that's not an argument that can be heard in the court, just to be clear.
Right, that's right. The court shouldn't be deciding whether or not.
Well, maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. I don't know. That's kind of a separate question, but they can't right now.
Well, right. But I think that, okay. But in our system, the courts shouldn't be deciding whether or not
they do, though, right? Huh? Because effectively they do, because the sneaky thing about liberalism is that it allows a whole set of actually substantive commitments to masquerade as neutral objective reality. So in other words, individual rights and private property as core commitments of liberal legalism, right? And privilege will always privilege like free enterprise and above, you know, any sort of communitarian claim to like economic justice. Do you see what I mean? So, in reality, there are substantive commitments that are embodied in the system, but the system is always lying to us about that. And that's
what you're talking about, material advantages. You're not just talking about, it's not like there's something built into the rules. It's that they're like, you know, for instance, when they took the Affordable Care Act into the Supreme Court, I think they did that, right? And I think it was around the issue of whether or not it had violated the Constitution by mandating that everyone had to buy a product, this insurance, right? So that was maybe a violation of people's rights. And while that was politically motivated, whether or not to deter, you know, to even take that to court or to find that it was had standing, you know, that there was someone standing and that it was worth taking on as a question, that was all kind of, there were political decisions there, but in fact, it was a problem with the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, sure. There are lots of problems. Yeah, of course. But right.
There was a real legal question there. Now, they came out in favor of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, part of it. Yeah. But my point is that the framework of individual rights, let's say, as the way in which we're supposed to advance our projects in life, right? Mm-hmm. Political and otherwise, is going to always privilege certain outcomes over others. Okay? So it's going to privilege the privatization of political outcomes.
Oh, so I'm not so sure that when you're talking about you're talking about property here, right?
Property, like anything. Like but this is just something I've been thinking about.
What do you mean when you say privatization?
Where
the money goes, who gets it, that kind of
thing. No. But even how we think about the right itself, how we think about the right. So the issue of reproductive justice is one. And I've been thinking about this a lot over the past few days, but it's one really great example of this, because when you say, as Roe v. Wade said, a woman has a right to choose privately whether or not she wants to terminate a pregnancy, right? That is a negative right. It's not a positive right. It doesn't do anything to ensure that it can actually be materially exercised in society. It makes part of the woman's internal life.
Yeah, like basically the market will determine whether she can do it.
So the right of privacy was read into the 14th Amendment, and that's, I mean, the most neoliberal thing we could think about to turn reproductive justice into a question of privacy. As opposed to like a public good that the state should be ensuring is available, right?
Right. Well, so here's the question. So what you're saying is the state has no obligation to provide the resources to make sure that people
have
access to. That's what the state
did decide in 1980. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So the conservative classical liberal would say that they didn't want the state making those kinds of decisions about what people are obligated to provide each other, but that should be the work of free individuals to decide.
Yeah, that's just a libertarian argument.
Right.
That's libertarianism.
Right. But I think – right. So I think libertarianism and classical liberalism are kind of aligned.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, of course.
So,
yeah.
Right. So now The Marxist objection to the libertarian would be to say that there's a whole class of people who don't have the power to determine what their community produces and what is made in their community.
There's a whole class of people that can't access the negative right.
That's right. But if you grant the libertarian his argument, if you say you're right, we don't want the state doing this. We still have a problem. We don't have free individuals in our community that have equal power and access to the material world. There are your property relations are already limiting how these some individuals can operate in the world. So we can't ever have an expression yes. of real communal values here amongst free individuals. What we can always only the only thing we can ever have is, you know, the expression of a class. And then that class, by the way, isn't even acting in its own interest. It's acting in the interest of an abstract system that we've devised in order to produce and distribute goods in the world, which has its own logic and, you know, which you can read about in Capital Volume 1. So,
yeah.
Right. So, like, so there's the objection to it from Marxists. The Marxist objection is not, oh, you're privatizing what should be done through some community structure.
Well, effectively, like it is, state. Though, because the only way to address material disparity is through the state in some fashion.
Or through direct control of the means of production by the working class.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, all right. But okay. So,
but yeah, sure. Or that. Okay. But
right. So I'm just wanting to point out, like, there's this alternate left kind of utopian vision that you could have and not have to have recourse to those. Yeah,
sure. Okay. So of course, that's, you're totally right. That's absolutely right. But I just think we're like so – that's so on – like
– Habermas is walking through the room saying, yeah, we've got this instrumental – communication going on. Okay, so
immediate.
But here's the thing. Okay, I'll grant you that we live in the real world, and that my vision is not about to happen. So let's stay in the yeah, we're so well within capitalism.
I would say to that exactly. Yeah.
So I want to ask you this. I'm gonna. I don't know if I've actually gotten to the point about friend foe exactly, but let's just say. I think that the friend-foe distinction is a really interesting one, which maybe I'll do a podcast episode on Schmidt sometime. But let's move away from that and actually get to the stuff people want to talk about, this Kavanaugh thing, which, by the way, the only day I ever watched of that confirmation proceeding or whatever is when Ford was on the was testifying and when he was testifying about it. I didn't listen to anything else.
That tells us everything you need to know in a nutshell, doesn't it?
Yeah, I didn't care about it that much. I mean, because to me, it seemed like whether it was Kavanaugh or someone else, they were all going to have pretty much the same conservative Christian agenda of, you know, launching attacks through the courts if they could at Roe versus Wade. And that was the only issue that anyone was really talking about either. But I was surprised that you, who've been a critic of Me Too, were willing to say that you thought it should be deployed in a sort of friend enemy way, in other words, as a tool of destruction to go after Kavanaugh.
Okay, so let me specify this. So what I did say,
and that was on Twitter, not in your essay.
No, I stand by this. So, well, I said that some other podcast, but I do think so. So I think it has to be, the left needs to. Basically, the situation is so dire that we have to do whatever we can. Short
right. You're saying there's a state of exception right now.
So no. So that's too. So I'm not faulting you for saying that, but I think that kind of a statement is a misreading of Schmidt. That's the sort of misreading of Schmidt that gets bandied about, and why people think that he's simplistic and has nothing to offer a political analysis. So I can't decide whether there's a state of exception because I'm not the sovereign. And I'm not the sovereign because I can't decide whether there's a state of exception. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's not up to ordinary people. So for Schmidt, it's not up to ordinary people to decide whether who's the enemy and who's not. And why is that? Because the moment we do, we are then entitled to kill them. So if one be an actual Schmidtian and decide, well, this is an exceptional moment, we have to do whatever we can to win, that means actual war on Schmidtian.
I think we need to figure out what plane we're operating on.
Yeah. So Schmidt is really useful here, but not for that reason. Okay. So from my idea with Me Too is to say, look, I endorse, I think Kavanaugh is such an animal and is so dangerous, and not just him, you're right, many others would be equally dangerous. It's so dangerous that we should be willing to deploy tactics that draw on social realities. I'm not, because I don't think Me Too is a movement, so I'm calling it some kind of social phenomenon, that draw on social phenomenon that we are deeply critical of. In order to achieve short-term objectives, namely preventing Kavanaugh or somebody like him ending up on the Supreme Court, okay? That I still endorse. But that's not any sort of friend-enemy thing. That's just a choice about a tactic in a situation, right?
Well, okay, so can I push back on this a little bit?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. All right, so here's my thinking on this, is that there are different rules that operate in society. It's not all just the legal system. It's not all just the economic system, but there's also rules. Some of them are, most of them are informal and only half understood, maybe, that help us get through our everyday social interactions, and there are cultural rules. And there's etiquette and civility and all that kind of stuff, right? And some of them sort of rhyme with things you'll find in the legal system. So people will say, oh, there should be a presumption of innocence, right? And of course, that doesn't apply in the realm of newspaper reporting. Legal. I mean, it may or may not, but it certainly doesn't apply on Twitter. Okay, there's no presumption of innocence that's mandated on Twitter. But out of politeness and sort of just civil interaction, operating as though it did apply is a good rule of thumb. Right? So.
Well, I mean, it depends.
Well.
I would just say it depends, really.
Well, whether or not it's a good rule of thumb?
Well, yeah, because what do you mean by, like, I don't. It's just unclear to me what it means to behave as if.
When I encounter
there were a
you,
presumption, yeah,
and you ahead. Say something that to me sounds like, oh, enemy. Like, I think Thaddeus won that podcast debate with you, or I'm on that team, Thaddeus.
Oh my god, you said
so I don't say, oh well. She's guilty through and through of being the enemy. I kind of for a moment.
Presumption of innocence, and that if is. We're use, if I don't think that has anything to. That's not even a good use of the presumption of innocence.
Okay, go ahead.
You know what I mean? Like, I just think that's just like basic. How do you deal with human beings and relationships in such a way that you can navigate them to everybody's mutual benefit? Do you know what I mean? So that's. I don't think that's got anything to do with like presumption of innocence. I just think that's like a.
How am I misusing that idea?
It's a presumption. No, I mean, a presumption of innocence is simply to say that you're not going to sentence someone to prison or the gallows, as you have them in the United States. That
it means that in social life, it means that you don't treat them as if they should be ostracized, or if it's okay, or they are so bad that it's okay to treat into act as if they shouldn't have any social standing. You don't have the power to put them in, you know, in prison, but you can treat them in such a way so that you're signaling very, very strongly to other people around you that they should be ostracized.
I just find that a principle of like, if that were me personally, I would describe that just as, judicious social interactions between human beings that, you know, be giving someone the benefit of the doubt, for example.
And if you're on social media, you can presume innocence, at least to the extent that you don't think that someone should lose their job without evidence, without going through some sort of, due process. Mm-hmm. That you're not going to just call for their heads without really knowing, without doing anything that would at least.
I mean, what's really interesting to me, so to complicate that this discussion a little bit, what's interesting to me in particular with respect to Me Too, because it seems to kind of galvanize these discussions, is that ideas, commitments that good liberals or even good progressives, right, mm-hmm. and maybe even many leftists would be committed to institutionally, in other words, the presumption of innocence and due process and that sort of thing. When these ideas start getting deployed in sort of the quote unquote ordinary space of social discourse, whether on social media or on, you know, television or in the newspaper, whatever, or just in ordinary parlance, what's happened, interestingly, is that they take on a conservative inflection, right? So now when you're on, like you're telling me, oh, Heidi, I was deploying a certain attitude that I might think of as presumption of innocence in my interpersonal reactions with you before I knew you or whatever. Mm-hmm. But now the moment you go on Twitter and you object to somebody saying some creepy man should be fired immediately, and if you respond, if one responds, oh, but we have to worry about due process, then one gets labeled a reactionary or a conservative.
Right.
Right. So there's an interesting way in which those ordinarily really liberal commitments get coded.
Right.
As conservative. And then even using those terms then has a whole series of knock-on effects that the person using the term most likely doesn't intend or want.
Right. And so I would say that maybe that's because this sort of, I know I'm really like watering down the concept here of this
conception. No,
so please bear with me.
But no.
I think there's because there's kind of a built-in state of exception.
Right.
In life, because we actually don't have the time to, or the ability to play the game long enough for it to seem really fair. So instead of listening attentively and thinking thoroughly and looking for evidence and checking our facts and considering what people are saying literally, mm-hmm. We look for cues that will tell us whether they're friend or foe.
Right.
And and so, you know, once we've determined friend or foe, then we can determine how we're going to respond. And yeah, so what
happens is... But can you please not call it friend and foe, though? Because I think actually that's just, that's regular. I don't think it's about friend and foe. And I think when we call it friend and foe, we're actually doing the same thing with Schmidt's language. Like we're misreading Schmidt in...
Okay, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
So how about in or out? How about that?
We're making friend foe into another due process thing.
How about whether you're a member of the tribe or not?
Yeah. So I think what's going on there is like basic partisanship. So, you know, so and you see that if I actually like I suppose it's my job, but
Are you saying like it's possible you can say you can hear someone and hear a cue? It's like a, oh, what about due process? You can hear that and you can think, oh, they are not friend or foe, but they're a member of the Green Party or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you can say they're a member of a party that I am opposed to, but that doesn't make them enemy in the Schmittian sense. It might make them enemy in some other sense, but what I'm saying, if we're going to be doing a Schmittian reading, it doesn't make them enemy in a Schmittian sense. What makes them enemy in a Schmittian sense is when you put them on in like when you put Kavanaugh on essentially on trial, right? Because mm-hmm. you're trying to literally eradicate him. Now, again, this is a metaphorization in some sense, right? Because I'm not sure that the Democrats are actually positioned for like legit civil war, although maybe, you know, right now. But my reading when I was trying to say that from the a Democratic strategic or rather lack of strategic point of view, they were trying to run a show trial with regard to Kavanaugh precisely because they wanted to eliminate him as a political enemy. But that involved the show trialness was a whole procedure and process. Right.
Right.
And so and I think that has an effect on partisanship and political interaction and sort of like daily life. But there's something to the added legalization of the process that that is doing something different. The addition of the trial, right?
Right.
Is doing work that goes beyond just signaling something in a conversation.
So what would they have done with Christine Ford's allegations if they weren't going to try this tactic of bringing in Me Too and using something that was extra political? Would they have just brought them forward early enough in the confirmation process or early enough in the process of selecting so that Kavanaugh wouldn't have been even picked and the whole thing would have been, you know, not a problem? Basically, it would have been a problem for Kavanaugh, but not for the nation. Is that what they would have done?
I mean, so this is – I want to be careful here because I don't think – so a lot of the response I've gotten to the piece has been to say, well, what should they have done?
I'm not saying what should they have done. I'm saying what would they have done if they weren't deploying this tactic, even unconsciously?
Right. So a couple of things. It's not clear to me that there's anything that they could or would have done that would have had, or even plausibly could have had, a different outcome because of the basic, like, numbers, right? They don't have the raw political power. And that's a very Schmittian understanding as well.
Right.
So the reason why this show trial failed from a Schmittian perspective is that, like, they didn't have the actual power to get it going. If they had the power, it would have succeeded. Okay, fine. That's true. But that being said, what I'm worried about is what gets lost when we deploy the let's call it the Me Too strategy here or whatever, right? Mm. So when we deploy the Me Too strategy, we're it's not so much the fact that it's being deployed that's bad, because as I said already before, I might have been willing, you know, to take a series of losses in order to get a short-term win. Mm-hmm. But what's really problematic about using Me Too in this kind of a situation is that it can only be a short-term strategy. It doesn't have a long-term view, and it's not a political project, right? So Me Too itself is just I don't think at all. It's just fundamentally not political. It's reactionary, and it's not emancipatory.
Now, when you're saying political, it sounds like you're not really holding with the
– No, I don't mean Schmitt's the political. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
I just mean – so party politics, like just achieving things in the political system, is different from Schmitt's conception of the political. Like those – like he differentiates very clearly between the political, in other words, determining who's the sovereign and who's friend and enemy. That's a different question from doing party politics within a domestic.
How does he make that distinction? Like a regular party
just
politics.
It's not the same as party politics.
What is party politics then? I mean, I know what I understand the party, the sovereign has power and he just makes his decision. And then there's through raw strength basically determines friend or foe. But what goes on between people politically in a party?
So in concept of the political, he doesn't have an affirmative vision of domestic politics as such, and in part because he wants to make his theory of the political applicable across a variety of political configurations, right? So it's, in other words, it can be, I mean, any range of, we can do, there's the idea of democracy, right? And there are many different forms, obviously, of direct representational, whatever, democracy, there's totalitarianism, there's all sorts of modes of doing governance and politics that are not really important to him from the point of view of figuring out what the political is. What's important, though, is that a political entity for him is only a political entity if there is a certain sense of internal peace, right? So he talks about that in terms of the normal situation, right? So there has to be a domestic norm that is peaceful enough such that individual citizens, let's say if we're talking about a state in the general sense, are able to be protected in a basic way by the state power. That's a basic Hobbesian point. And in other words, the moment that starts breaking down, like the moment that basic peace and functionality breaks down, then you actually get the emergence of an internal enemy, and then the state is sort of in a preparation for civil war, which of course can happen. It does happen all the time, right? So there needs to be so there are ways of managing. This is where Schmidt and Schler are actually an interesting conversation as well, because every domestic system will have ways of managing this notion of the internal enemy. And so when you think about a law like treason laws, basically treason, it's sort of the, or, you know, in old British colonial times, that would be an offense against the king, for example. That is, a way of managing the internal enemy, right? So it's a way of putting that person outside of the political sphere because they create a threat to the sovereign, right. The sovereign himself, let him.
So it seems to me like one of the things that, that we can say about the political, this sort of everyday domestic, political process is that it's a process of struggle, but struggle between friends, between people who are all
absolutely
sharing
that's and perfect. Absolutely. Absolutely. A struggle between friends. Yeah.
If the Democrats had been, let's just say, willing to treat the Republicans as friends in a political process, then they would have acted differently.
That's interesting. Let me think about that. Yeah, I mean, sort of. I think my basic contention here is that what we lose when the Democrats turn to Me Too is a real substantive political contestation on basically all of the other issues that are important to those who are not on the right, right? Whether So we don't have any, we lose the notion that actually what's going to help is having struggle, political struggle, like at the legislative level, at the grassroots level, this kind of stuff, right?
Right. All normal politics.
We exactly.
Give up on the idea. Yeah. I remember after Trump was elected, I was talking to, at the time, a friend who's no longer a friend of mine, who's a Marxist.
Right.
And I said, look, I understand this is really upsetting, but don't we have to sort of depend if we're worried about fascists in the street?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we have to at the start at least try to depend upon sort of civil society and camaraderie amongst just Americans, say?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that we're not going to round each other up because we are like together in some way. And we can't just go off into the street and assume that everyone with a MAGA hat needs to be shot. And
no, for sure. Yeah.
Right. And the response from my former friend was he didn't even know what I was talking about.
No, I think you're totally right. And I want to be clear too, like that is not some kind of milquetoast turn to civility. Like that's not what either of us are talking about.
No.
We're just that's a different
issue. Specifically because we're worried about the breakdown
exactly.
of society and the looming threat of extrajudicial detention, say, or all sorts of, you know, the apparatus of spying on citizens and the power that Trump has. It's because we're concerned about those things as leftists that we want to build strong ties to people who even don't think like us in our community.
Yeah. And what's really important about that is that's the kind of thing which I, you know, doing that means that we're not focusing as obsessively on the courts, and in particular the Supreme Court, as though that's where all the politics happens, right? It doesn't. So the law can neither save us or even really be as destructive as people think it is, right? So everyone just thinks now, well, Kavanaugh's on the Supreme Court, therefore there's not, it's, you know, all is lost and there's nothing we can do. And that's not true. It's like, no, you still have the political process. Of course, it's like very difficult right now because this is a very dark political time, but dark political times happen. And actually what's so useful about Schmidt's concept of the political from the perspective of internal politics is that he was really worried about the importation or the transplant of this friend-enemy distinction within domestic politics. Like he doesn't want it. He's saying, look, you're in a very bad situation. You have to understand, right? When you start making those moves, like the Democrat tried to do, what you're doing is essentially declaring civil war. And if you do that, you need to be like prepared for it.
Right.
And I don't think the Democrats even realize that what, and you're exactly what you, so that's a great example with your friend. Like, I think that essentially what he or she or they were doing was effectively advocating civil war without realizing it.
Right.
You know,
it was a weird move. I won't go in down that path anymore with.
No, but just that kind of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. They were absolutely.
That political disposition.
And look, if there ever is a revolution, it may have elements that look a lot like a civil war.
Yeah.
Right. But we don't want to start a civil war because try to start a civil war by just running around punching people that aren't like us in the face and, you know, and then waiting to get rounded up for our crimes by the racist cops. Right. It's just dumb politically. Yeah. But okay. So the other thing, no, that's not to say that Antifa doesn't have a role to play, and not, you know, not
yeah, sure.
Right. Not, God, I'm being hazed by Twitter, so I'm a little testy. not this second because I've actually turned it off, but anyway,
that's important to your mental health.
Yes. but what I'll say is this, and I want to look. Actually, what I want to do now is like bracket, because I think we come to some agreement. I'm going to actually re-listen to our conversation probably a couple of times now, because I still feel like there's some questions that are in the back of my mind. But
oh yeah, we're kind of going all over the place, but I don't know. I'm having fun.
It's good. I feel like we're going, you know, all over the place in a tight circle in a way. And what I want to get at are some of the kind of dumb TV questions that you might get and I'll actually risk like sounding like Bill Burr or someone. You know,